details of the new law. Our correspondent Folashade Ogunrinde tells us more.
Since President Muhammadu Buhari signed the much-talked-about Petroleum Industry Bill into law, one of the most prominent concerns it has raised is whether or not the pump price of petrol will go up for as high as 300 naira per litre. Usually, the impact of fuel price hike is felt first in the public transportation system, where bus operators jack up fares and commuters pay more.
In every way, the driver or every transport company will have to increase the price of or the tariff at which they take to wherever it is that they are going to.
Looking at it, in the other hand, when I buy fuel at the rate of 300 and something naira, I'm likely to increase the transport fare so that I can meet up to go and come and buy the fuel again and go back.
It's going to affect a lot. Not only transportation will affect, it will affect even people selling foodstuff. It will affect anything that affects transport, that affects fuel, will affect every other thing.
For standard living in a common man in Nigeria now, how can you buy fuel for 360 naira and you are receiving a minimum wage of 30,000 naira? Logic, how does that gel? It doesn't work.
The government has decided to maintain the petrol subsidy contrary to expectations. Now, what's your take on this decision?
You know, the question of oil subsidy is one thing that is so opaque that Nigerians don't understand what the subsidy is and where the subsidy comes from. Many times they've told us they've stopped paying subsidies, but then we find that they're still paying subsidies. So it's like something, there's something political beneath the subsidy argument. And if you ask me, the actual subsidy we have in the oil sector, the petroleum sector, is a subsidy provided by the environment that is being trashed, subsidy provided by the communities who are being polluted and contaminated, whose livelihoods are destroyed. And so we just hope that government will wake up one day and tell us exactly how much does the petrol imported or produced locally cost, and how much are we paying at the pump price, and stop playing politics with subsidies.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nimo Basay, for your insight on the new petroleum law in Nigeria. Let's take a short break now, and when we come back, we shall talk about global fashion brands polluting African rivers. Stay with us.
Global fashion brands polluting African rivers.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
A new report shows that production of clothing, including for high street brands in Europe and the US, is killing Africa's rivers through polluting discharges of untreated industrial water. Now, the report by Water Witness International showcased the polluted rivers in Lesotho in Southern Africa and Tanzania to highlight the risks posed by global brands increasingly sourcing clothing from entrepreneurs in Africa, attracted by cheap labor and tax incentives.
Nick Hepworth, Water Witness International Manager and author of the report, identified around 50 international brands that source or have purchased their clothes in African countries, including Zara from Inditex, ASOS and H&M. One of the rivers affected by untreated wastewater from factories producing garments for global brands is the Simbazi River that flows across Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Now for an incisive analysis on how global fashion brands are involved directly or indirectly in polluting African water bodies in general and rivers in particular, we have contacted Dr. Nick Hepworth, the Water Witness International Manager, who authored the damming report. Thanks for joining us. Now, can you first tell us why these global brands prefer producing their products in African countries?
Sure. Africa still has just a fraction of the global trade with the fashion market, and it's shadowed by the big producers in Asia. But it's a really important potential driver of job creation and economic growth in Africa. For example, before the pandemic, selling clothes to the global fashion brands was worth about $4.6 billion a year to the African continent. And producers are drawn there by a combination of cheap labour costs and overheads, probably the cheapest labour on the planet, and tax incentives from national governments keen to grow the sector, and favourable trade deals that have emerged over the past few years, which relieve duty on imports from Africa to the US and Europe.
Well, quite unfortunate there that cheap African labour is a major incentive for global fashion brands producing their products in Africa, and I guess that would qualify for modern slavery or neo-slavery.
The European Union has a comprehensive liability regime for damages to the environment based on the polluter pays principle. This legislation has pushed out manufacturers that disregard protection of the environment, forcing them to relocate to third world countries where there are less stringent laws. Why are these fashion brands disregarding the protection of the environment of African countries while they would not dare do the same in Western countries?
Well, many of the fashion brands are outsourcing production to middlemen, to factories which are largely owned by Asian companies across Africa. And again, they play a really important role in generating employment and export revenue. But the brands are also outsourcing pollution and impacts on water, because the regulatory controls that are in place are very weak or not enforced. And so by not enforcing strict standards on their suppliers, the brands are turning a blind eye on the pollution that their production and their supply chains are creating. National governments are often feel as though their hands are tied. They're reluctant to enforce pollution control on factories that employ thousands of people, because they fear that the production will simply shift next door.
The United States and the European Union have established programs which give African countries duty-free access to their consumer markets. In a bid to create employment for thousands of their citizens, most of these African countries rush to set up factories with little regard for the environment. The governments of the EU and the US pushed for agreements to produce these garments in Africa. Are they complicit in the destruction of the environment by these global fashion brands?
Absolutely. Just to that point, you know, it's really important, particularly given COVID and the climate emergency, that we do all we can to ensure that everybody has access to safe water, sanitation and hygiene, and is protected from droughts and floods. And the global supply chains and companies and brands producing in Africa have an important role to play. Certainly the governments that have negotiated improved trade deals have an important role to play to ensure that the companies, the supply chains and the financiers behind this sector in Africa are compelled to comply with pollution control law and ethical standards of production. And they can do that in a number of ways, attaching disclosure of good performance to the export and import licenses, for example, and enabling companies to be prosecuted and sanctioned for abuse of human rights and water, no matter where they work in the world.
A government can play a critical role if there is political will to implement tough environmental laws that will compel manufacturers to implement good manufacturing practices friendly to the ecosystem. Citizens have the right to water, and factories must be cognizant of this fact. An activist in Tanzania speaks here on the need to protect water from pollution.
Sote tuna haki ya maji safi na salama kwa matumizi ya binadamu na uhai. Tuna wajibu kuhakikisha vyanzo vyetu vya maji havichafuliwi.
Now, what should governments of consumer countries do to ensure that factories producing garments for these global fashion brands do not destroy the environment?
Well, we need to see strong and immediate political leadership to draft and enforce legislation which requires companies to meet basic standards of social justice and environmental protection throughout their supply chains. And also a requirement on the financiers and investments and the banks behind those companies to disclose performance and to divest from companies that continue to abuse water and local communities.
Now, consumers are gradually becoming more engaged in sustainability topics. Many now are demanding that fashion players uphold their social and environmental responsibilities. Now, what's the role of consumers in ensuring that the products they use are compliant to the protection of the environment?
That's a great question. You know, whether we like it or not, the global markets have a huge influence on the way we use the planet's resources and on communities across the planet. There's a really important role for consumers because markets respond to consumer demand. So we need consumers to step up to ask questions and demand the responsible use of water in the production of the food, of the clothes, of the computers that they consume. That's what's going to drive change, and that needs to happen and happen quickly.
Well, yes, indeed. There is need for urgent action to be taken to stop the pollution of African waters by global fashion brands. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you watching, and please do send us your comments through our social media handle. Goodbye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The American presence in war-ravaged Afghanistan, often described as a graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but actually fanned its flames. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor and blogger with over 12 years of experience who has reported extensively from Kashmir, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan and Iran for leading publications worldwide. The piece is titled How Post-9/11 US War on Terror Spawned Terrorism. The brutish and long-drawn-out American war on terrorism that began in the wake of the suspicious 9/11 attacks 20 years ago has only spawned more terrorism and more insecurity. The military invasion of Afghanistan started with the Pentagon carpet bombing the landlocked country with B-52 heavy bombers and gunships. The disastrously misguided and disproportionate response to the cataclysmic events of 9/11 found expression in the so-called global war on terror, which has since consumed tens of thousands of lives from Afghanistan to Iraq and elsewhere. The nasty, brutish and long-drawn-out war on terror has only spawned more terrorism, despite successive regimes in Washington and their Western allies trying to conceal the truth. 20 years on, the war-ravaged country again finds itself at a crossroads. The Taliban fighters are back in power, Al-Qaeda is still around and thriving, while Daesh terrorist group has quietly and stunningly made its way from Iraq and Syria to Afghanistan. That's how America's ominous presence breeds terrorism rather than annihilating it. In the aftermath of the suspicious 9/11 attacks, Americans vowed to crush every terrorist group within their reach, including Al-Qaeda. Former U.S. President George W. Bush famously declared on 20th of September 2001, "The U.S. war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but does not end there." The impudence was clearly evident. Invasion of Afghanistan less than a month after four hijacked American planes crashed into landmark buildings in New York and Washington on 11th of September 2001, killing 2,977 people, was reckless, poorly planned and shoddily executed. As the U.S. dispatched long-range B-52, Stratofortress strategic bombers, AC-130, Spectre gunships, and MQ-9 Reaper drones to flatten the Tora Bora cave complex in eastern Afghanistan, where Osama bin Laden was reported to be hiding, Barbara Lee was the only U.S. congresswoman to vote against authorizing what was to turn out to be America's longest war in history. Barbara Lee was labeled a traitor by those who championed the military invasion that incurred an astronomically high cost, with innocent Afghan civilians bearing the brunt. The mindless war found support among both U.S. Republicans and Democrats as they rallied behind George W. Bush and his hawkish Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to exact the revenge. The bombing campaign was launched on 7th of October 2001 under pretext of decimating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and capturing the 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden, the former CIA ally and the founder of Al-Qaeda, who was apparently hosted by the Taliban. The core objective of the three-week bombing campaign, dubbed Operation Enduring Freedom, was achieved in less than 3 months. But the Americans decided against quitting Afghanistan. There was certainly more to it than that, beyond the bluff and bluster of fighting terrorism. If eliminating Al-Qaeda and the Taliban or taking out Osama bin Laden were prime objectives of the military invasion, the U.S.-led Allied troops would have called it quits long ago. But the aim was to occupy Afghanistan to make the mineral-rich country strategically located between Central and South Asia subservient to the West. was clear from the way George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld snubbed the Taliban's offer of a truce to avoid confrontation. Before the bombardment began, the group offered to hand over Osama bin Laden to a third country for trial and even agreed to lay down arms and recognize the government in Kabul led by Hamid Karzai. The offers were spurned, leading to a 20-year military adventure that ended in the worst U.S. military and strategic debacle. The American public, who initially supported the idea of military action against the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks, eventually became its fierce opponents, as the futile war dragged on for years, metamorphosing into the worst U.S. foreign policy disaster. For 20 years, the war in Afghanistan remained an enigma for the successive U.S. administrations from George W. Bush to Joe Biden. After invading the country and destroying it beyond recognition, George W. Bush abandoned Afghanistan and launched another costly military adventure in neighboring Iraq in 2003. Both experiments proved counterproductive. His successor, Barack Obama, refocused on Afghanistan, killing bin Laden 10 years after the suspicious 9/11 attacks, not in the mountains of Afghanistan, but in the Pakistani city of Abbottabad, a short jog from military base. Barack Obama then began the drawdown but stopped short of complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. Years later, his successor Donald Trump signed a deal with the Taliban, pledging to withdraw American occupying forces from Afghanistan. It was the same militant group his fellow Republican president George W. Bush once vowed to decimate. Donald Trump was consigned to the dustbin of history before he could execute the plan. It was his successor Joe Biden, his political rival, who finally pulled the plug on America's longest war. The disastrous war ended in August of 2021, the way it started in October of 2001, in a violent, disorderly, shambolic, reckless fashion. Amidst the chaotic evacuation of Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport, a Daesh suicide bomber blew himself up, killing more than 200 people, including 13 U.S. service members. The ghastly incident underscored not only the vulnerability of ordinary Afghans, but also the U.S. failure to eliminate the threat of terrorism in Afghanistan. More importantly, it also blew the lid off the sinister interventionism and hegemonic ambitions of the U.S. military-industrial complex in foreign lands, from Somalia to Afghanistan. As reporters later revealed, many of those killed at the Kabul airport didn't fell to suicide bombings but to indiscriminate firefight by American occupation forces. More civilians were to perish hours later in the U.S. drone strike, including Afghan women and children. So, as some pundits would argue, 20 years after the doomed U.S. military mission began in Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden has won the war posthumously. The American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but it actually fanned its flames.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If there was no Battle of Karbala, we would be oblivious to Islam's principles today. May 2nd, 2008. If this battle had not taken place in Karbala, we would not be aware of the principles of Islam to the extent we are today, and there was probably just a nominal trace of Islam. Not only were this great event and the holy blood of the martyrs not undermined, but they also gained more prominence in the history. This is an outstanding example. Sayyida Zainab, Sukaina, and the innocent girls and women recognized the magnitude of Ashura. May 2, 2008. Everyone was wondering what had happened on the day of Ashura. The greatness of the event, the greatness of the jihad done by the Prophet's loved ones and his companions was not known to anyone. Neither was the magnitude of the catastrophe in which the Holy Prophet's sons and loved ones were martyred. The majority of those who were present in that battle did not recognize the importance of this issue, and those who were fighting for the enemies were so ignorant and unaware that they did not realize what had happened. Those enchanted by arrogance, lust, and animal urges cannot understand what is happening in the human world. Of course, Sayyida Zainab, Sukaina, and those innocent girls and women did recognize the magnitude of the event. This is what happened on the day of Ashura.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Events of Ashura live on due to Zainab and Imam Sajjad, peace be upon them. September 20th, 1989. If Zainab al-Kubra and Imam Sajjad had not fought or revealed and interpreted the truth of Ashura's philosophy or the purpose of Hussein ibn Ali and the enemy's oppression during the days of captivity in the evening of Ashura in Karbala, in the following days en route to Sham and Kufa, and in the city of Sham, then on the pilgrimage of Karbala, and while moving to Medina and during the many years that these great figures lived, the event of Ashura wouldn't have survived and remained as vivacious till this day.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Lebanon has announced the formation of a new government in an attempt to put an end to the country's 13-month political deadlock. Prime Minister Najib Mirati's list of ministers, which consists of 24 members, includes many technocrats. Lebanon has been headed by a caretaker government since Prime Minister Hassan Diab resigned in the wake of the catastrophic Beirut port explosion in August 2020, which killed over 200 people. Since then, Lebanese political groups had failed to resolve their differences. Fuel shortages in Lebanon have forced businesses and government offices to close, threatening to cause blackouts at hospitals and halt transportation. The crisis has been exacerbated by U.S. sanctions as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs. First joining us on tonight's program, we have our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who's with us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mariam, if you're with us, tell us about the significance of the political developments in Lebanon right now.
Well, it is very important. However, it is not the only step that should be taken. This is just the first step ahead in the 1,000 miles that we need to take in order for us to resolve the crisis in Lebanon. Of course, this government on its own cannot resolve the crisis. We heard also from the European Union stressing to the new government that they know their first job, their first duty, which is the long overdue reforms that need to be taken by the Lebanese government in order to deserve, as they say, new funds that are coming in. Of course, that would be perhaps the first reaction from foreign sides. We also have congratulations from other countries. However, they're all eyeing this government specifically. Now, we did not see, of course, people very much with high hopes, because what they want to see is that they can find and provide for their families on a daily basis, that the price of the dollar is not as high as it reached in the last few months. They want to be able to take their kids to school. They want to be able to provide medication for the ill. So these are just basic needs that we're looking at, in addition to the fuel crisis, with what's happening in hospitals and schools that are also, of course, threatened not opening. So these are some of the things that Prime Minister Najib Mikati mentioned himself, and he said that, "I will knock on all doors. I will not leave a stone unturned without trying to, of course, doing my best in order to help resolve the crisis with the team that he has put together in accordance with, of course, President Michel Aoun." Of course, although these are newcomers, they're not politicized. They don't belong directly to political groups. However, they were endorsed by different political factions because it is necessary to have that endorsement in order to ensure that there will be confidence for the government so the government can do its job. We will be seeing perhaps in the next week a meeting by the parliament to study the cabinet manifesto and to see if they can provide a vote of confidence for this cabinet in what time it has left in order for it to be able to do something to uplift this crisis, or at least put in a salvation plan, if we may say.
All right, thanks a lot. Mariam Saleh joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Let's take a look at the guests that we have for tonight's show. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas is joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let's start off with Mr. Magny in Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Elijah, what are some of the immediate challenges for the new government in Lebanon?
Hello, and thank you for having me. I think Miriam summarized very well the situation in Lebanon. And what is obvious is there are no miracles to be expected from this government. And around 20 out of 24 are linked directly to the political parties and decision maker in the country. So when we're talking about the political reforms, it's going to be quite difficult to reform a country when we have the election coming up next year and the same people are ruling again in the country. So basically, facing the challenges of the daily life needs and the basic daily life needs, like no electricity, no gasoline, and no diesel, the winter is coming, devaluation of the local currency, there is a free fall of everything in the country. People are migrating from Lebanon and trying to look for a better life or at least a decent life, because it can't be worse for the people in Lebanon who are not used to this kind of life ever before, even during the civil war in 1975 and the Israeli war. They lived a better life than it is today. So I don't think there are a high expectation. The devaluation of the lira stopped for a few, 24 hours, but I don't think it's going to remain going down and gaining. The Lebanese lira is not going to continue gaining over the dollar because there is no money in the country. And the foreign countries are saying, well, start with your reforms first, and then we can supply you with money or with support, but that is always conditioned. So is it going to privatize everything in the country when people can't afford their daily life and their basic needs? That's going to be a very big challenge for the new government.
Sayed Mohsen Abbas, a lot of talk about reforms for a new government in Lebanon. What are, in your opinion, the most urgent reforms a future government has to tackle?
Well, I think the most urgent reform is that nations like Lebanon, like Iran, like Syria, those nations which are constantly sanctioned by the United States and by the money mafia around the world, first of all, they need to start thinking about resistance economies rather than constantly relying on the dollar-linked, what I call neoliberal economies. And this has been what the fundamental problem for Lebanon has really been, is that they were tied in by their head of the central bank, Mr. Salameh, into the dollar to the extent where, you know, everything is basically beholden to the Americans. And of course, given the political significance of Lebanon, insofar as Hezbollah and the clash with Israel is concerned, and the broader involvement of the U.S. in the Middle East, of course, then this becomes a playground for certainly what I call the Anglo-Zionist Empire to take hold of. I mean, they don't fundamentally, first of all, want a Lebanon that is strong, unified, and that can stand and resist Israel, for a start. Secondly, they have their own puppets within the country. Of course, there's a large number of politicians and factions around the Hariri camp in particular, which are which would much rather be with Americans and the Saudis, etc. So there is a collision of ideologies as well going on here, political ideologies. But of course, when the whole Salameh strategy of tying to the dollar's collapse, what you had was, of course, the impact on the street and the crowds that gathered to try to get the government to move to create ease for them, given all the financial hardships and their lack of access to the dollars that they essentially had tied up in those banks. The Western powers, the Anglo-Zionist empire, smelled blood, so they fermented even more of those problems at that time. And alongside that strategy of trying to blame Hezbollah for all of this economic crisis, which is clearly what the Americans did at that time, and their proxies inside Lebanon. They also followed through Trump's administration a policy of tightening the economic noose further by making negotiations with the International Monetary Fund the only option for the government to receive any kind of relief, on the condition, of course, that reforms must be first implemented, which they're still, of course, pushing. So, you know, no one questioned the need for deep and structural change in the Lebanese economy, but the IMF's usual fare, as we know, of austerity and privatization, it often results essentially in countries falling deeper into a cycle of debt and dependency. So while they might want to go down the lines that these the international powers are saying to them, that won't necessarily rescue their economy or Lebanon.
Elijah Magnier, in the past, Hezbollah has warned that the U.S. had been responsible for obstructing efforts to form a government. What were Washington's motives in that regard, and will such disruptive efforts continue now?
The U.S. motive at the beginning for the first couple of years since 2019 was to cripple the Lebanese economy and to turn the population against Hezbollah, and so they can consider that it is because Hezbollah has weapons, deterrence weapons against Israel, this is the cause of all the troubles of the country. Therefore, Hezbollah needs to be disarmed. What happened is the Lebanese were very much aware that all the friends of the U.S. are the ones accused of corruption who ruled the country since 1990. And it is not Hezbollah who is responsible for the corruption and the crisis in the country. Moreover, what happened is that when the Hezbollah leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said that he's not going to allow the population to starve, and at least the society that protects the party and also the allies of Hezbollah. And this is when the threat has turned into an opportunity, and Hezbollah asked Iran to supply food first, second, medical supply, and a third, the oil tanker. When the U.S. saw that their sanctions are mainly affected their own people, and then Hezbollah and Iran are benefiting from the sanctions imposed on Syria and in consequences on Iran, on Lebanon, then they realized that what they are doing is to fall into the hands of Iran and Hezbollah by reinforcing the Hezbollah-Iran camp in Lebanon and giving another opportunity for the axis of the resistance to use this opportunity and to supply the Lebanese population and to show the Lebanese population the difference between the American and their allies' behavior toward Lebanon and Iran and its allies' behavior toward the population. And this is what turned everything upside down and pushed the U.S. ambassador in Beirut to say, well, wait a minute, we can supply you with gas coming from Egypt. And what happened is today we have the Americans working very hard to bring the gas from Egypt, and that's going to take 6 to 8 months. On the other hand, the Iranian tankers are not going to stop. So what they have done is they have provided more ammunition, if we can say, and more elements for Iran and Hezbollah to grow their popularity among the population.
Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, when the U.S. warned Beirut about obtaining fuel from Iran, the counteroffer that Washington had, which was importing fuel from Egypt and electricity from Jordan via Syria, which itself is under U.S. sanctions, did that make any sense at all?
Well, Syria is sanctioned from supplying anything, so it doesn't make any sense. But this is the nature of the American imperialist policy in the Middle East. It makes no sense. It makes no sense for the U.S. in terms of its economic prosperity, but it's primarily obviously serving the interests of the wider Israeli Yinon plan in that region, and it's committed to that due to all the Israeli lobbies and their long-standing links. So we all know this, that the U.S. is not really calling the shots on the policy around the Middle East. We know that Tel Aviv and Israel are pushing for anything that happens with its neighbors, and the U.S. Senators and the Congress basically say amen no matter what that policy is, no matter how diabolically harmful it is to the Americans. So the U.S. economic sanctions, let's just take that as one example of the absolute stupidity, really, of this policy of trying to attack Lebanon or even take on the axis of the resistance. You've got, no matter how smart, essentially, Washington claims themselves to be, they rarely, if ever, brought down the targeted regime or group, because that's what they're trying to do in Lebanon. They want to bring down the regime that might have a deference to Hezbollah or supports them, of course, the Christian Maronites, the Amal group, and Hezbollah and others are united in trying to keep the Americans from basically engineering their society and controlling Lebanon. So they're fighting essentially for the independence and sovereignty of Lebanon. But in most recent cases where the U.S. has tried this business of targeted sort of regime change, it's had the opposite effect. And as Elijah was saying earlier, really, it highlights the fact that it simply strengthens the hand of the state that is in power, basically by impoverishing the population and making it more dependent on the government and its support and assistance. So one only has to even look at the 13-year international economic blockade against Iraq and Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait. And there are many, many other examples of this. They've sure. constantly done it. But they must really think again and understand that economic sanctions won't work. Military, if you like, bullying won't work in that region. It's a new West Asia, and if they could only get away from the grip of Israel and actually coordinate a policy of justice and fairness in the region, okay. they might still stand a chance of salvaging some sort of economic link there eventually.
Mr. Abbas, allow me to intervene here, jump in for a second. This is for you as well. Amidst the fuel and energy crisis, how come no Arab country has offered assistance to Lebanon to alleviate some of the pressure that the nation is experiencing right now?
Well, the Arab nations that you talk about are essentially puppet proxies. I mean, we've seen the whole Abraham Accords and the sort of the whole Trump era efforts to essentially normalize Israel, and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have openly done so. The Saudis have also all but done it in name. I mean, they're behind the scenes collaborating, cooperating in every way that you could possibly imagine. So essentially, these Arab governments are ruled by individuals who have been brought to power by the Anglo-Zionist Empire and are maintained by the Anglo-Zionist Empire. They financially support the siphoning of most of the wealth of that region into real estate and other investments and Swiss bank accounts. That's their primary purpose, leaving those countries essentially just as actually from a manufacturing and from a stability point of view, just as weak as they were before the Anglo-Zionist Empire essentially took over the reins.
Right.
So it's nothing from them. Those powers will only move if they think that Iran, as it's doing, has a chance of having too much of a hold on Lebanon. Then it's the possibility, as you can see, that they are forced to come in and try and play a brinksmanship game there.
Mr. Magnier, regionally, who benefits from uncertainty and instability in Lebanon?
The Americans and Israel benefit from the instability in Lebanon, because that will turn the attention of the axis of the resistance domestically, rather than protecting the borders and preventing Israel from fiddling with the maritime borders and trying to steal the wealth energy of the country. This is something that we've seen also in Syria, which is exactly the same, because the Lebanon has only borders with Syria, and the instability in both countries is essential for what the Americans call the safety of Israel. So this is what they've tried hard in the past in different ways, by waging war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, by dividing Syria, and by allowing the Takfiri to rule. Now they try the economic sanction, and this is where they are failing, because as I said, the opportunity came, and the Americans fell into their own trap by removing temporarily the Caesar Act on Syria and allowing it to import the gas from Egypt. So the instability that the U.S. is looking forward to have in Lebanon and Syria is really empowering Syria and Lebanon at the end of the day.
And Mr. Abbas, let's turn our attention to the round after round of U.S. sanctions. These sanctions have been called an act of aggression against all of Lebanon. Why is the United States piling the pressure on the Lebanese people, on all of Lebanon, when the nation is so obviously suffering?
Well, they intended to do it on the actual section of the establishment which was in support of Hezbollah or was actually standing for the sovereignty of Lebanon, as far as I can see. But that has backfired. The fact is that there were billions of dollars of debt which were there, not because of the fault of the Lebanese people, but actually due to the civil war and the money that was injected after the civil war. That money was, let's face it, there was a huge kind of set of corrupt individuals and organizations that have had to essentially divide the pie. Now, that's just a legacy which Lebanon has been left with, but it's been compounded by the IMF and the kind of Americans and all of these forces which basically want Lebanon to bend its knee to essentially Israel. That's what they're trying to persuade, and they're doing everything in their powers, but it's failing. It seems to me that the axis of resistance has got the upper hand. In Lebanon, I cannot see these economic sanctions working. The more they do them, the more the population will turn against the Americans and their stooges in Lebanon. And as soon as the stooges find that the heat is coming on them, you'll find that they'll soon start dropping their kind of the policies they're trying to roll out there. But the Lebanese people are intelligent people. They will see through most of the situation. I think Hezbollah and Saeed Nasrallah is playing a very formidable hand in all this. And the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran is there on every level. And I think they're just waiting for the word just as to how much support Lebanon requires. Of course, Lebanon should look east, because beyond Iran, there is China, of course, there's Russia and the Eurasian axis. This is the game in the Middle East that is going on now, that these nations need to cut free from the slavery imposed by the Anglo-Zionist empire economically, and they need to find new ways of surviving, new economies, resistance economies that are not linked to the Anglo-Zionists.
All right, gentlemen, thank you. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. That was journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from